Hello and welcome to War Within a Breath. We're back again. I'm Anthony and my co-bro here is Michael. Say what's up.
Hello.
Hello. Today we're finally going to focus on the biggest metal band of all time without a shred of a doubt, Metallica. It's been in the works for a long time, been talking about it since we started this thing, just kind of waiting for, you know, our paths to cross properly. Yeah, we do have a guest. We'll get to him a little bit later on. But first I want to mention, it's been quite a while since we put up another episode, but we actually did one a couple weeks ago, and it was lost due to technical difficulties. It's probably Michael's fault.
It's probably your fault, that's just, douchebag.
That's how I feel, yeah. So yeah, due to someone's technical difficulties, we lost an episode in which we talked about Psilosis' new album, which was a huge deal for both of us. We'd, you know, greatly been looking forward to it for a long time. And we also went over, I guess, like reverse New Year's resolutions for each other. Like, I assigned you a couple albums to go and listen to, and you gave me a couple.
Yes.
So I guess we can quickly just kind of hit up on that rather than record the whole thing again, because who's got time for that shit, right?
Right.
So you assigned me two Arch Enemy albums and the Banners album from last year.
Right.
And Wages of Sin was the first one you gave me. I feel like, yeah, that's pretty okay. Anthems of Rebellion, though, I feel like fucking crushes Wages of Sin. I really, really like Anthems of Rebellion. I've continued to listen to it. And the Banner, basically, I don't remember anything about it, which leads me to believe that you just kind of couldn't think of another one to give me. And it's like, yeah, I like this album. What does he think of it? That's kind of how I feel about that.
I really like that album a lot. I thought it would be rather right up your alley. So I out of all of them, that's the one I thought the most about that you would end up liking.
It's funny because it's got me written all over it, that sludgy, like hard-hitting, you know, dark shit. And I don't know. I just didn't get into it.
Yeah, oh, I'm sorry. Well, you gave me the new, you gave me the Queensryche album. What's it called?
Mm-hmm. What is it called, really? Really?
I don't have Operation it pulled up in Mindfire. Front of me. You kind of put me Operation on the spot here. Mindfire. I thought we were just going to talk about Psilosis.
Operation Mindcrime,
yeah,
Michael.
That one.
Listen to it again.
Like I said, between that, Ulcerate and the Atlas Moth, I like the Queensryche album the most. It was my first experience. Well, I wouldn't say it's my first experience, but with an album, a storytelling album, I really enjoyed it. It's kind of okay to me. Ulcerate was good, dark death metal. I liked it, but something just didn't stick with me. And then the Atlas Moth, you can take that one and keep it yourself. I did not care for that.
Oh, it's unfortunate. I knew you weren't going to like it, but I was hoping there'd be like some shred of something in there that you could latch onto. I don't know. I almost wonder if that's a band you just have to be like feeling super depressed to get into or something. I went into my situation when I got into that album, and I don't know, maybe that'll wait for another time. Maybe they'll release another album. But that was basically it. I assigned Michael three of my all-time favorites, and he gave me two Arch Enemy albums and the Banner.
So you told me that you thought a little bit differently about the Psilosis album since we actually tried to record that. So tell me what you think now.
I did. So, I mean, basically we both generally came to the same conclusion, right? That the album could have been outstanding if not for a glaring mistake that must have occurred in like post-production or somewhere else in the recording process, which just becomes all too recognizable and predictable at the most unfortunate times. And you know it's coming, and so like earlier and earlier in the song, you're like, oh, this song's so good, but that fucking part is coming up, and I hate it. You know, it's nearly ruined some of the best tracks. And in the meantime, I mean, I've listened to it quite a bit more, had a bit of a change of heart, and basically I've been searching for an analogy which justifies me giving it a higher grade. And I found one, and that's that I wouldn't call a human being a worse one just because they were born with a cleft lip or something, you know? So I'm not going to knock Psilosis just because their album has this annoying little glitch in recording that they probably didn't have any control over anyway. So I'm going to assign it a B+. And I don't remember what I gave it before, but I am going to declare it their best album. With an unfortunate side effect.
No, I mean, I have to disagree still. I think it's a colossal error. It's a beeping sound that gets recorded, that is recording basically throughout every way every instance that you hear. I guess what do you call that? A metronome?
It just sounds like a metronome, yeah, because it's clicking along with like the strumming of the guitar.
I think it's a colossal just misstep by the band, the producers, the label, everything. I think it ruined the album.
I mean, it's probably not the band's fault. Let's be honest.
I don't know.
And looking back, I've listened to it a lot, and you can hear a shred of it sometimes, but the one big time is in To Build a Tomb, and it's in probably one of the, like, the best moments in the entire album. I don't know if you would agree with that, but it's so overwhelming at that point. It just leaves this really bad taste in your mouth, and it's like, for such a great song and such a triumphant moment, it's really a shame. But then I go back and I think about, you know, old. So we're going to talk about Metallica today, and their first four albums sounds like a bag of assholes, man. They just don't sound good at all. But I can overlook that because the music's that good. So that's how I'm going to rationalize this.
Yeah, we'll agree to disagree on that one. I just think it's a travesty because it should be one of their best albums or the best album of theirs, and it's just I can't do it. It's awful.
It is a shame. It really is.
I'm so disappointed.
So we're going to move on to Metallica now. That's pretty much all we talked about last time.
Sounds like a great episode.
Yeah, it's so good. Yeah, the secret is I just destroyed this thing after I listened to it later. I was like, man, that was garbage. Just deleted it myself. Yeah.
Well.
So anyway, we do have a guest today. I'm going to let Michael introduce because he's a buddy of yours.
Yeah. So, John, are you there?
No, I'm here.
John, hey, thanks for listening to that brief podcast we just had.
It was wonderful. It's great.
Yeah. John is basically a resident expert on Metallica. All things. He's a self-proclaimed, what would you call yourself, John? Self-proclaimed biggest fan that you've ever heard of?
Yeah, I think I've said that before. I've said it when I was, like, really drunk, but said, like, I'm the biggest Metallica fan I've ever seen, or something like that. But, I don't know the good word for it, I guess. But,
but John is going to join us to talk all things Metallica today. We're going to go over top 10 and the history, discography, everything. It's Metallica Day, so we're gonna have some fun with that. And Anthony, why don't you take us on?
Well, we're probably gonna start off here with our top 10 favorite songs, which is fucking impossible. If you're a fan of Metallica, like, you just, there's probably five songs on every album at least that you love. Like, maybe I think I've got five songs I really like on Saint Anger. I don't know. We'll get into Saint Anger later on, but let's go ahead and start off with our top 10. It was really hard. So for 10 through 6, John, what we typically do is just kind of, you know, list them off real quick, and then we'll give some more description, some more reasoning as to why our top 5 are our top 5. I don't want to make the guest start. I'll start. So my number 10 is Until It Sleeps. My number 9 is Battery. My number 8 is Orion. Number 7 is The Unforgiven. And number 6 is My Friend of Misery.
I like that.
Like that.
I guess My Friend of Misery, I didn't even think about that. I played bass guitar, and that was like one of the first songs.
Isn't that such a cool song?
Oh, yeah. I think it's one of the only Newsted writing credits on Black Album, I think,
right.
too.
Yeah.
Which I think is just because he wrote that original riff that goes in and out. But but I like that. Yeah, Until It Sleeps, again, another small, you know, I think some people dismiss Load as a...
I think a lot of people dismiss Load.
You know, I can dismiss Reload. I understand that. Load to me, I think, is a little underrated because I think people were so upset with cutting their hair and changing their sound so dramatically that I think people just kind of forget how, in my opinion anyway, I think it's a really great album.
Me too. Load shows up farther up on my top 5 too.
Sure, absolutely. But no, I like that. It's a good list.
Cool. What do you think, Michael?
Yeah, I liked it too. I see some similarities there, but no.
You saw Battery at my number 9. You were thinking that was my favorite.
Dude, I swear I've heard you talk about how much you love Battery.
I do love Battery much.
Okay, well, I just underestimated your love for Metallica. Then my apologies. Mm-hmm.
I think that top 6 through 10 that shows me a lot of who you are, Anthony. I could probably tell you, you know, your birth date and. But you get family members for Christmas. I mean, just that list just shows a lot. I like that.
Right.
I was expecting like a flurry of Kill 'Em All and Ride the Lightning. So I'm surprised.
Right.
That's good. Good work.
All right, John, you want to go ahead with your 6 through 10 or 10?
Sure. And I think we talked about this before we started recording, but my list has changed quite a bit. If I did this a couple years ago to today,
oh, yeah.
So I've kind of I guess, been flipping and flopping on them. So I was coming up with a top 10 list, and I really, it's really like a top 12, so it's like an honorable mention, so I'll throw that one in there. But
okay.
There's two Death Magnetic songs. It's All Nightmare Long and Suicide Redemption. They're instrumental. But the 10 is Sanitarium, 9 Blackened, 8 Call of Cthulhu, 7 Bell Tolls, and 6 Master Puppets.
Call of Cthulhu, that's interesting.
Yeah,
I'm into that.
I love all of their instrumentals. I think that they're unbelievable. Lars, in an interview, once said that I think it was on the promotion tour for St. Anger before it came out, and they asked him, oh, is an instrumental going to be on this? And he said, I don't think we need to put any filler material on this album. And I was like, and I'm like, you motherfucker. I was so irritated when he said that. It wasn't even funny.
Oh, what a jerk. Yeah.
Oh, man. Yeah, I really like that. Call of Cthulhu is a really underrated song. Golly, I haven't listened to that one in a while.
You know, I love the version on the Symphony album when they did that.
Oh, yes.
Because I think when that first came out, I didn't realize, and if you listen to the song, there's like a on the Ride the Lightning album anyway, there's like a low end. It's kind of mixed funky. It's like a bass solo that goes pretty much throughout the song. It's just a wah pedal distorted, and you don't really hear it too much off the Ride the Lightning recording, but you hear it quite a bit off the S&M recording, and I thought it was just super cool.
Awesome, awesome.
All right, Michael, let's hear yours.
My number 10 is Orion. Number 9 is Battery. Number 8 is No Leaf Clover. Number 7 is Bell Tolls. And number 6 is Fight Fire with Fire.
Nice.
So I had Fight Fire with Fire, but they were the number. It was like the number 12th and 13th. But
right. I just like that song.
I love that song.
It is just so brutal. To me, it just sounds so much different. And you could say that for a few Metallica songs, more than a few. But it sounds so much different, that I think, than any other Metallica song.
Well, I love it just because it came out in 1984, and it has that kind of like delicate intro, and then just slams right into it. And I don't know if anything was going on in 1984 besides Poison and Motley Crue, but you know, of something that sounded anything like that at that time.
Not really.
Yeah, exactly.
No, not much.
And they play that song live too. They speed it up like almost two times the tempo, and it's insane.
Golly.
Pretty insane.
I can't imagine any faster.
Well, they play that. They'll always do when the Fight Fire Fire chorus comes up. I've seen them several times in concert where the flames, like there's like a 20-foot flame shoots up. I don't know why that's like burned in my memory, but it's pretty intense live anyway.
Cool, cool. Not bad. I'm into that list.
I like No Leaf Clover too. That's an underrated.
I really like that song.
Yeah, I thought I might get a little bit of flack for putting a symphony song up there, but I've just always really, really liked that. I considered moving that up and putting it in my top 5, but I couldn't squeeze it in with what I already had up there.
Yeah, I remember Metallica recorded like a B-side version of that, of without the symphony, and it sounded really bizarre, and I think it got some flack, because from what I hear, it was supposed to be on, I guess, St. Anger. It would be the next album, but...
But
I think it got some flack, so they took it off, and they just left it as a standalone with the S&M. Hmm. But I love that song, too.
Yeah, for sure. I'm a big fan of S&M. I mean, like, our favorite Metallica albums will probably come up later on. S&M's near the top for me.
Sure.
So we'll go ahead and get into number 5 here. And my number 5, I just remember this was the turning point for me as a Metallica fan, because they'd always been that band that I like. I told Michael before you hopped on, John, that it wasn't the first album I'd ever heard. I'd heard, like, all their stuff. But the first album I'd ever purchased was Reload, because, you know, at the time, I just had to drive so far to get CDs, and I think I had to drive to, like, St. Louis to get a CD, and I live in, like, northeast Missouri. And to find a Metallica CD, I had to go to, like, fucking St. Louis. And it was Reload. So... I had to work my way backwards from that. Later on, I picked up the Black Album, and then later on, I picked up Ride the Lightning. And this song is on Ride the Lightning, and Fade to Black is the song that really turned me from, like, yeah, I really like Metallica, to, dude, I fucking love Metallica, you know? And I love how quiet it is to start, how fucking dark it is. It's so sad. It's depressing, you know, but then, man, those triumphant, heavy-ass guitars and Kirk's solo at the end is what really pushes it over the top for me. I love Fade to Black, and I feel like that's not just a turning point for me as, like, a metal fan, but that's a turning point for, like, metal in history.
I totally agree. Yeah, that is up there on my list as well, but, I mean, it's one of my favorite songs. For sure.
Yeah, it is. It definitely, you talk about having a different sound, Fade to Black definitely has that, and that feeling. It's kind of started, I feel like, maybe they saw the success with that, and maybe saw that they could go a little softer side, and maybe that led into kind of some of the changing of the guard of what they do.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, that formula was repeated, like, to the T for one.
Oh, yeah.
And even to a point, Sanitarium, so...
Well, you said that format, really, I mean, it's not even just the verse, chorus, bridge, chorus. It's like a light, clean guitar tuned regular tuning with mm-hmm. the solo kind of played over it, which, again, exactly like one. But, yeah, there's several songs like that formula has been repeated. But
absolutely.
Yep.
Awesome. John, why don't you go your number five?
My number five, and you're talking kind of the influence of some of these things with S&M especially. From the Load album, the Bleeding Me, that's my number five song. I liked the song when Load came out. That was the first album I bought for Metallica. I liked it off the album, but when you hear the S&M version, it's just kind of an epic kind of sound.
It's so good.
Yep, it's simple, but it's catchy as hell. I mean, there's probably, I didn't really count, but there could be 10 different riffs in that song that they use and kind of and I think kind of beautifully put together. But I think with the solos and basically the dynamics of it too with the S&M, it's just I don't know. I think it's just kind of a beautiful song in my opinion, especially with the S&M recording of it. But that made me really just say, oh, wow, this is a really good song. Maybe I should go back and listen to Load. And then I kind of had like a Load kick for a long time just off the S&M version of Bleeding Me. So that one's kind of brain burned in my memory from that album. I think it was No Leaf Clover that you're just like, ooh, this is new. This is the great song. And then Bleeding Me really just, so that's my number five.
Isn't that a pretty long song too?
Yeah, I think it's like nine-minute range, I think.
It's longer.
Yeah.
You can find it online, but there's actually a piece of Bleeding Me that they edited out during the recording process. That song is supposed to be like 12, 13 minutes long. But,
wow.
Yeah, they actually edited it down, which I don't think Metallica does very often, just from the length of all their recordings.
Very cool.
Man, you have no idea how much I love that you put that song on there. Like, it's going to be higher up on my list. I figured I was going to get called out for my love for Load on here.
I thought so, too. Actually, when I put that number five, I'm like, I bet they're gonna pick that one apart. So I'm surprised we have a good mutual love here on some of this stuff.
Yep. Believe me, so good.
So I'll go my number five. This is from the first Metallica album I own. It's actually the self-titled, the Black album. The first song I think I ever remember hearing double bass it was from this album. It was Wherever I May Roam. Mm-hmm. That's my favorite song from that album. It's just, I don't know. I love the way it starts with the guitar, and it just, it's such a cool song, and the heavy double bass. It was, I always thought it was pretty faint, obviously, when I got into later in the metal, but that song's always stuck with me. It's one of my favorites.
Yeah, I love that song. I think for me, the Black album, which is absent from my top 10 list, I think it's mostly because of just I've heard it so many times. It's just it's gotten old to me, and I think kind of just going off of making this list 5 years ago, I think this would have been littered with Black album things. But mm-hmm. it is a great song. I love that song. But I've heard so much Black album, and I think part of that was in high school when I was really in Metallica doing, there was a weight room like after school, and literally they had one cassette tape, and it was the Black album, and that's all, they never changed it. And I heard it 100 times straight through, and that's when I walked in originally and said, this is awesome, I love this, they're playing Metallica, and by the end of a couple years, I'm just like, can we play something else besides So I have to try to keep some perspective on it. But, yeah, I love that song. Great song.
That's actually, man, that's like on the low end of my like Metallica songs that I enjoy. It's, I love how it starts with Lars just like pounding the snare drum, you know, and it gets so heavy right there, and I just hate it from there on.
Really?
I've never been a big fan of wherever I may roam, especially like the part that I really hate is Kirk's solo in the end. Just never been a fan. It just sounds like a Hendrix ripoff, and I've just never been a fan of that.
See, I like the bridge portion of it, of the song before the solo. That's kind of I don't know. It's kind of a cool. But I hear what you're saying. It is a fairly traditional solo, but yeah.
I think my favorite part of that song is just how it ends out with the constant double bass. It's about 5.5 minutes in. It's only like 6.5 minute song, and it's just the repetitive just. I love it. Just beats down. I love it.
Yeah, I know I'm in the minority. That's been a live staple of theirs ever since it came out. So that's me. I get it.
That's all right.
So moving on, number four. It's a Black Album song for me. I think it's the only one on my list. Nope, that's a lie. I had the Unforgiven earlier. Okay, so number four. Michael and I were talking about this again before you hopped on, John. Mm-hmm. He asked me what my favorite song from the Black Album was, and I told him that it's The Struggle Within. And I said that if that was the first song on the album, the perception of the Black Album would be so different than it is now, because everybody just thinks Enter Sandman and that's it, you know, at least in like the modern metal community. But if The Struggle Within started that album...
I think it ends the album now, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. Yeah. If it was the first track, though, like you can really draw some comparisons between that and Blackened and Battery with the way it starts, and it just this build up, it's so beautiful, and then it's thrashy. Like that, it's one of their last like true classical era like thrash pieces to me, and I've always loved The Struggle Within, and it never gets any love. And I think like last year is the first time they ever played it live ever.
Yeah, I was just gonna say that. I don't know if they've ever played it live. They played a ton of things. I think it was like Phantom Lord and a bunch of things they've never really played in a really long time.
Yeah, they played Escape last year too.
Yeah, exactly.
But The Struggle Within, I've always been a big fan of that. The God That Failed as well is another one that I've been a big fan of.
Yeah, that back end of the album, mentions. I don't think gets as much love for sure. I do like that. That Failed. Struggle Within, it never really hit me right. I don't know why, but I don't know if it was just the rest of the album, or by the end of the album, I'm just like fatigued by the time.
Right,
it is. But I hear you. I understand. I maybe I should give a listen to that song some more.
I think it's just like the way that it starts, and like if you think of it, like man, if this was the first song on the album. It would just really, it would feel really, really different.
I agree 100% on that. But I think when I hear the beginning of that song, I get kind of pumped up, like, ooh, this is going to be a good one. And I think I'm just underwhelmed with the rest of the song.
I think I'm right with you on that. It feels like it kind of lets down a little bit, but.
But holy cow, yeah, it's absolutely a thrashy song, and I think it would have a different perception, because I went and listened to it when you told me that, Anthony, and I was like, oh yeah, this is way different from End of the Sandman. So, but yeah, that the back end of the album, yeah, I remember listening to this and thinking, yeah, this beginning part's cool, and then I feel like I would click it off after that part or something.
Right.
All right, this is my turn, I guess.
It is your turn.
Sorry. Yep.
We'll give you more direction going forward.
Yeah, sorry. I guess my number four is one. You know, it's obviously staple. I've heard it a billion times. What actually recharged me as far as that song goes is the, I don't know if you guys saw the 3D movie, the Through the Never concert flick, but they had a really cool one. They play like this big video screen and really try to portray this is more of a, you know, and that kind of military, you know, anti-military song, and more of kind of an epic kind of thing. But we were kind of talking about earlier with how, you know, the bread and butter clean guitar tune, regular tuning with, you know, solos over the top. This song, I remember the first time I heard one just with the double bass going and how the dynamics of it, just it's just intense, 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 and then just stops. And I remember the first time I heard that, literally I like got chills when the song was over, and
at the end of the song,
it just crescendo up, 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 and then just stops, and I'm just like, holy shit, what was that? So that was, I don't know, just with the soloing over the guitars, and then just the dynamics of the song, and how Metallica can somehow create these catchy as hell, clean, non-distorted, non-tuned riffs that just they just shoot out on a regular basis. It's just unbelievable to me. But so that's my number four.
Cool. You know what turns me off about that song? And it's weird, but I don't like the chorus in that song. And I don't like it to the point that I rarely listen to that song.
Really?
Yeah. Like, I love the rest of it. Even thinking about it now, it's like all those clean parts, especially, like, the bridge between the first chorus and the second verse. Like, I love, love some of that stuff. And the end of the song is just untouchable. Like, I totally agree with what you're saying there. But fuck, man, I hate the chorus of that song. I remember the music video in, like, the early 90s. It played all the time. And I really, really like the music video. And I just remember thinking, like, man, we've got to hear this damn chorus, like, three times, and they cut off most of the end of the song. Like, I don't even want to listen to this song anymore. And again, I know I'm in the minority with that, but it's a great song. It's a really good song.
Yeah. Yeah, it's one of my favorites. I think that was definitely going to be one of my just barely missed the cut songs. I really like that song a lot. Well, I guess I'll go with my number four. Same album. It's Blackened. You talk about a song just like so many of the other ones we talked about, with the really cool intro, really soft. Man, I really, really, really like this song.
Yeah, you just know something mean's coming, right?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Like it's just so just it gets louder. There's not like any distortion, but it's just you feel like you're in a room and it's just. Things are coming towards you, and it's just the it's great. One of my favorite songs of all time. I love this song. I don't know why I have it as number four. I keep talking about how much I love it, and it's only at number four. I'm starting to rethink. See, Anthony, this is what's pissing me off. I told you that I couldn't figure out my top five, and it was pissing me off, and now I'm thinking I should have put Black and higher.
Well, you should have started earlier, I guess.
Sure.
Oh, yeah, you know that, I don't know if you're aware or not, the intro to Blackened is actually guitar recording, and then they flipped it backwards.
Right.
So it's you can kind of hear the pick, and then the sound, or the sound, and then the pick sound at the end. So it kind of flips up at the end of the intro. But I agree.
Yeah, it's cool.
Wonderful song. This song actually was, I think, the glue that put me into super fan realm.
Right.
I don't know if you guys have the live shit Binge and Purge. Box set at all, but the video that's they had a couple of recordings, and they had one from Seattle 1989, and they come out with the song. And I remember the first time, because to me this song is unbelievable, just as a guitar player, just because of how intense the down picking is on this song. They down pick the hell out of this, and then what blew me away too is, and really actually gave me some respect for Jason Newsted, is that he down picks and plays with the guitars. And that song on that recording, they speed the hell out of it up. It's so much faster than the album. And and Michael too. I listened to that As I Lay Dying, the Blackened cover, and they play it kind of at the same tempo as the album. But that 1989 is literally they're playing it so fast, and they're down picking so quickly. It's like this band is just unbelievably talented. I'm just like, absolutely. I mean, not that I didn't know that before, but that recording just solidified it to me as far as fandom. I think just kind of like this is. I was just in awe seeing that live, and actually watched it on YouTube a couple hours ago, just in prep for this, just to get me all pumped up. So
I'm about to check that out. That sounds awesome.
1989, yeah. Seattle live shit. It's all on YouTube. It's fantastic.
Live shit's so good, though. Like you just got to watch all that stuff. It's so awesome.
Yep. The part too that there's a, it's, I think they play Blackened and then Beltolls back to back, and the Beltolls part, they flick on the house lights and like the camera's on Lars, and Lars like points out to the crowd and they show the crowd and everybody's going like ape shit, and it's like just packed with people. Like I literally get chills just watching, even just thinking about that. It's a little pathetic, but you know, whatever.
Yep, I'm with you. Me too. All right. So moving on to my number three, it's a song we talked about a little bit ago, Bleeding Me. Hmm. And this was, this was when I knew that Metallica was capable of a lot more than just what I knew from them, because Bleeding Me wasn't a song that you ever heard anybody talk about.
I don't think it wasn't a single either, I don't think.
No, not that I'm aware of. But I think, like, later on, Metallica figured out, like, wait, this song's good, and people, like, really respond to this because they start playing it live and stuff. It was probably around S&M that they realized, like, ah, this song works really well. We should play it, you know. But I think I was going back, and all I had ever heard people talk about with Metallica was Enter Sandman and, you know, Sad But True, and then Reload, Memory Remains. And I come across this Bleeding Me song. I'm like, this is just a gorgeous song. It's so moody. Absolutely. And the part in the very end when the distortion's on and they play the main riff of the song, you know, dun, 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 and they play it with distortion at the end to bring it all back. That is like the chills part for me. And Kirk's solo in that song is so good and so just so beautiful. It really shows the dynamics that they have in their arsenal for playing songs that you wouldn't expect them to play. And I think, like, that song is the biggest reason that I never wrote off Load, and it's the reason that I gave it more of a chance. And I'm a big fan of Load. I've always been a big fan of Load, so that's why.
I think as well, it has like a mood to it, and it's almost like a bluesy feel a little bit to it too. It has kind of a groove that goes, and absolutely, it has a feel that other Metallica songs before it really didn't have.
Mm-hmm. Are you a fan of this song, Michael?
Yeah, we talked about it before. I didn't know as much about it as you guys did. I own Load, and I remember listening to that, and then I love the S&M album. I remember this more from the S&M album than Load, so I don't know if I just...
Oh, it's so good.
Oh, yeah. it's such a sharp song, but I was just listening to it here, and it's definitely a lot different on the S&M than how I remember it compared to the Load album. I'll have to kind of give it more time. It's a sharp song, and it surprises me that it's on Load. I think you definitely hit it on the head when you said, wait, you know, we can do this and still kind of be creative and crap.
You know, and the other thing about it is that was the point when I realized that, like, James Hetfield has a pretty excellent voice. And it's pretty diverse, and he basically explores, like, every aspect of what he can do in that song. And from that, like, what he does on S&M, I think that's his finest vocal performance of his entire career, S&M.
I'll take
and
that, too.
Just spot on, so perfect. And I felt like Bleeding Me was, oh, shit. I mean, I'll swoon over it to myself later on. We should just move on.
Well, you wonder, too, is if they didn't come out the song, like, Nothing Else Matters or anything like that, if Bleeding Me would have existed, you know, because, like, it's tested that kind of melodic groove feel on the Black album when Nothing Else Matters and seen such a good, you know, opinion and success from it. I wonder if that kind of led to being open to more recordings of something like that, I guess.
Yeah, probably.
And we're on number three, right?
Yeah.
Number three.
Okay. My number three, this song, I totally flew over it when I first started listening to Metallica, Sovereign Justice for All, and it swooped back to me, I don't know, probably like 6 or 7 years ago. It's To Live Is to Die, off the last album, or off the last song of the album. I had a buddy in college that he asked me to put together like a mix of Metallica, and we were at some party, we're drinking and everything, and he said, I have the album in my car, we should listen to it and talk about it. And I'm like, okay, you know, we were wasted. Like, all right, yeah, I'm sorry.
Let's talk about it.
Yeah, so this song came on, and basically, you know, for people who don't know, you know, it's one of the last songwriting credits to Cliff Burton. It's such a kind of a moving song, and at the end, there's basically a poem that Cliff Burton wrote that James Hetfield kind of speaks at the end of it. That it's more about like dying and, you know, take me home kind of thing, which has this incredible meaning, I think. But the beginning almost has a Fight Fire with Fire kind of feel to it, just kind of delicate guitars that kind of go into kind of a rock. Rock's kind of slower dynamic rock portion, but there's a really cool kind of layering and building of the song, and with the meaning of kind of a tribute to Cliff Burton, so to speak, it's just like one of the more moving and kind of songs that Metallica has in their mix, so that's my number three.
Yeah, I always thought that song was just flat out just a memoir or just a tribute to Cliff Burton. I didn't know he had anything to do with that song.
Yep. And I think he wrote, I don't know if he wrote some of the riffs on it or not, but Cliff is, and this actually shows up later in the rest of the list for me, but Cliff is actually credited at writing some of the guitar solos on some of the album that I don't think a lot of people are familiar with, but
right.
I think he might have wrote some of the guitars on To Live Is To Die, but I know he wrote kind of, he had like a lyric at the end that Cliff Burton wrote, so... But yeah, I just love how just kind of the tribute and how moving it is.
Well, I think Justice, to me anyway, that's why I love the Binge and Purge box set, especially the 89 recording, just the Justice tour when they play so many Justice songs live. I cannot stand how Justice for All was mixed. It is,
yeah,
Up with St. Anger is one of the worst mixed albums I've ever heard in my life.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, literally, they put there's no bass guitar on the whole song. I mean, or in the whole album, nope. Really. And that's why I really like hearing, like when you hear Black and Live, you can hear the bass guitar in it, and it adds so much to the song, I think, that you can't even tell off the original recording. And that's what really, it irritates me listening to the album, because it's just, it's such a horrible mix. I don't know, I would love to see them actually remaster that and remix it.
Jason's good at bass.
Yeah, I've actually heard rumblings that they may do that because Metallica, I don't know, a number of years ago, bought all their original recordings. So they own all their recordings when they switch from Elektra to their Blackened record, their own record label. So from what I heard, they have all the master tapes of Justice, and I've heard that they were talking about maybe doing that. But I would pay $100 to $500 for that, just a recording of that.
Right. Yeah.
That would be awesome. Justice is one of my favorite albums, and, oh, gosh, I can't even tell you how excited that would make me. It just makes me excited that that's even a possibility. I love the thought of having that remixed to hear a little bit more bass, bit more bass.
You can add that to the list of Metallica things that they can do after the next album comes out, in between, or maybe in between the next album, now and next album, that they could squeeze in to add another year of time before a new album comes out. So
you may
still see it.
All right. Well, I feel like you both had really, awesome stories of why your number threes are your favorite number threes. I really don't have a good story for why All Nightmare Long is my third favorite Metallica song.
I love that that's your third favorite song, by the way.
I love this song. I love the squealing by James in the chorus. I love how layered this song is. It sounds like five different metal songs pieced together. I love this song. It just, I had lost a lot of faith after St. Anger, and my first introduction to Alt Nightmare Long was the Guitar Hero Metallica edition. And I remember playing that and really enjoying it. I was like, this is a fun song to play. And then I remember going and listening to it on whatever I used to listen to music on, probably MySpace or something, I don't know. And I just, oh, man. This is for sure one of my favorite songs. I didn't have the heart to put it at one or two, and I still feel bad that I put Black in at number four. But
Don't feel bad about that. That's still a solid song.
Yeah. All Nightmare Long is just so cool. I love that song.
They made a video for that song. I don't know if anyone watches videos. Yeah, they did. It's almost like a Tool video, where it's like a claymation person running around, and they don't show any of the band.
Now Michael hates the song.
Yeah. But it's very bizarre. Most videos kind of have Metallica front and center. I mean, I guess one has a kind of a story going, but... But yeah, you don't see the whole band in the whole video.
But I didn't know they made a video for that.
Yeah, I don't think anybody watched it.
I don't know people made videos in the bar except for country singers. So.
And rap stars, yeah. No, that's not one of my... I don't dislike the song, but it's not one of my favorites on Death Magnetic at all. Like, I think there's several songs that I like more. But I think the way that you found it, Michael's probably... Maybe that's why you like it so much. I don't know.
Yeah. I love that song. It was in my honorable mention and for the top 10, but I think it's fantastic. Death Magnetic to me is so underrated. Maybe we'll talk about it later, but that whole album is just, if you look at it from face value and you just look at it saying, okay, you have intense riffs put together, they're catchy as hell, and even like you know, just some of the, like, Unforgiven 3, like, oh, you see the title of that, you're just like, oh, God, what are they doing? but, you know, when you actually listen, just at face value on some of the things, with how it's mixed and everything, it's really, and if you just kind of put down on paper objectively, it matches up a lot to Master Puppets. With just, you have your instrumentals, you have your Day That Never Comes has, like, kind of a fade to black type feel to it. There's a lot of similarities from Master Puppets to Death Magnetic, in my opinion, anyway. But I don't know. I think it doesn't get enough pub, so I'm happy that you put that in there.
Cool. So my number two, we've already talked about a little bit. The reason that this song started to resonate with me a little bit more was that I went and saw Between the Buried and Me in about 2005, I think it was. You mentioned this before. You said As I Lay Dying, but you meant Between the Buried and Me.
Oh, I'm sorry. See, that tells you how tough I am on the modern day music. I've told people before. I'm like my dad. My dad is into Yes and Billy Joel and all the stuff that he was into when he was about in that teenage year to 20-year pocket,
yeah.
And he never left. That's all he listens to today, and that is me to a T, which is sad. But.
Nice. So yeah, I went and saw Between the Buried and Me in like 2005, and Michael, this was like right after, or right before, what's that album called? Oh, The Anatomy Of came out. So right before their covers album came out, like after Alaska, before the covers album, and they played Black and Live, and I was like, is this... did they fucking cover Metallica? Because, like, Between the Buried and Me wasn't a big deal yet. Like, Alaska was where they really started to like, turn some heads, I think. And, man, that song just sounds mean as shit. And I went back to listen to it afterwards on Justice, and it's like, wait, this song was already pretty fucking mean. Like, this is a dark-ass, just vicious song, and I've loved it ever since. I mean, we talked about it quite a bit before, but, the number two, Blackened. I love that song so much, and it's constantly been moving up my list over the years, but nothing can take over number one, and it never will. So we'll get to that in a little bit.
Well, my number two is Orion from Master Puppets.
Nice.
I don't know, I started playing bass guitar. I was in middle school, and the kind of bridge version of the kind of almost like a lead rhythm portion played with bass, it just blew me away that... They go, wow, bass is not just a, you know, instrument that just sits in the background. Like, they're putting it front and center. You know, Cliff was just, to me, you know, such a interesting portion of, you know, early Metallica, just on the songwriting. From what I've read, that Cliff wrote the majority of the song, including the harmonic kind of... solos that are kind of later in the song with rhythm and James and Kirk are kind of playing over each other,
right.
Like with different octaves. Apparently that was written by Cliff. Cliff wrote just the majority of the song. And there's some of it, too, that the way Cliff distorts his bass, you think almost it's a guitar, but it's actually a bass on some of the soloing, which they're at the very end of the Through the Never concert movie, they play this on a stage with like house lights on. They're sitting in chairs with nobody in the audience. And it was
awesome.
Unbelievable. I sat there in the theater as the credits are on one side and they're playing this. And it is one of the cooler recordings. And really, you know, you just think about it, that this came out in 1986. There's nothing like this in that time frame. I mean, there's a good 10, 15 riffs in the song. You know, everybody has their piece. James plays a solo in it. Cliff or Rob plays it as well with Kurt Hammett. I mean, it's just a showcase of the band, of a song that nothing ever was like that before. Being really, you know, Call of Cthulhu came out. I don't think it was as popular. But this song really saying, hey, we make instrumentals and they're unfucking believable, so here it is. Mm-hmm. And so that just came, again, kind of came in my life when I was playing bass, and I was just obsessed with that song, and I still am. But so that's my number two.
By far, my favorite instrumental of theirs. I had it as my number 10, and I feel like I should have had it higher, but... I feel like I should have had all these higher.
I feel like I have a list, and then after talking to you guys, I'm like, oh, maybe I should move this up. Gosh, I need a list to struggle with anything.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I love how much they the feature the bass in this, and all of them, really, as you said. I think it's just the bass is something I wish I really would have gotten into, and I was always told by my dad because I was long and lanky and I had big hands that I could play it pretty well. And so even though I never played it, I always kind of had a soft spot for the bass, and I really, really appreciated the song and always found it fascinating.
Cool. Yeah, I agree with all those things. It was on my list, too.
Way to jump in with your own thoughts, Anthony.
No, I mean, he stole the point I was going to make, that it was in that movie that came out in 2013. I skipped a class and went to see it. And I was in the theater by myself because it was like 1 o'clock on a fucking Wednesday or something like that. And it was just perfect. It was a big like Omni, whatever they call it. I paid $20 for the ticket and I didn't care one bit. It was just, and I loved the way they ended it. And I was like, man, Orion is such a good song.
Don't feel bad. I saw that by myself too. No one would go see it with me. But
no, I mean like I was literally the only person in the theater.
I was so against Through the Never. I didn't want to see it. I heard about making a movie and with the story, and I'm like, I was as against this as anyone could be. And when I went in the theater, just going, I have to see it. I just have to, you know, because I feel like I wouldn't be a true Metallica fan if I just said F you to this thing. And I loved that. That was one of the cooler things. Metallica did an interview on Howard Stern. I'm a big Howard Stern fan, and Lars said that he said he came up to the director, and he's like, what's your ideas? And he goes, well, my idea is that all the concert movies you ever see is that you're in the crowd staring at the band, and he said that I think it'd be interesting if we got the cameras on stage, and instead of it's us looking at you, we're on stage looking out. And we kind of film you almost from the back and kind of see you. And especially seeing that in the, you know, big screen and everything, I've never seen a concert film really shot like that before. It makes you feel in some parts like you're up on stage. And it is one of the cooler things I think they've done. I loved it. But the ending there just made me solidify how much I loved Orion. But
is it my turn?
It's your turn.
Oh, my gosh. All right, so Anthony already told you this is going to be in my top five. And, John, you said you don't have any of the Garage songs on there, but I got to put Merciful Fate from the Garage album on there. I love this song. I actually like the Merciful Fate King Diamond version of this a lot, but I'm not a huge King Diamond fan. But when Metallica did this... because I got the Garage album. That was actually the Garage album was the second album I got after the Black album. I don't know what made me choose to do that, but that's what happened. And Merciful Fate has always been my favorite song on that album. I feel like they've truly turned it into their own song. They expanded the way that the main riff sound. They detailed the guitar solos and the breakdowns and they just kind of turned it on its side a little bit to make it more of a Metallica song. And I think it sounds completely different from the original in a good way. And it is one of my all-time favorite things that they have ever done. I love that Merciful Fate song in Garage. It's 11 minutes and 12 seconds. It is so long and so necessary. I just love that song.
I'll make my two quick points and then let John talk, all right?
I feel like I'm going to get lit up here.
Nope, I'm not going to do it. Point number one is I don't like King Diamond, and point number two is they made this song better.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
That is all.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
I can agree on both points with you, Anthony, but... I don't know. I never. I don't know. And again, I need to write this down and struggle with it to re-listen to this. But I don't know. I think Garage when they did the Revisited, I remember looking at the cover, going, okay, well, Jason looks like a douche on the cover. Lars has like a hat backwards, looking like I'm like this little small Danish guy is not going to be working in the Garage with like grease on his face. So I'm just like, this looks stupid. And I loved hearing like the kind of Blitzkrieg and some of the other Bread Van, some of the other recordings from the original Garage days, but I guess I've sort of dismissed this in my head as being like a true Metallica song. I really need to. I mean, like the Whiskey in the Jar and some of the other new recordings kind of trumped it as far as just airplay goes nationally. But I need to re-listen to this. I probably haven't listened to this version in, I don't know, 10 years. Probably. It's been a really long time.
But, Anthony, I feel like even though you didn't say much, I feel like you probably took what I said, which was a lot, and just conciced it down to my main points.
Bullet point.
Yeah, I mean, I don't mind King Diamond, but they totally made this song their own and made it better. And it
sounds great.
It's damn near a perfect song. I love it. It's great.
I think, like, I told you this earlier, again, before John hopped on there. My favorite song on that album is definitely Sabra Cadabra, the Black Sabbath cover.
Yes, that's great.
And it's one of my favorite Black Sabbath songs. And so, like, I felt like that always just overshadowed every other song on there because I really, really, really fucking hate Whiskey in the Jar and Tuesday's
in the
Gone.
Jar in the Jarro
in the Jarro
and
yeah
Tuesday Gone, the Happy Gilmore song.
Oh my god, I hate Tuesdays. Like I don't even want to get into like how much I hate that fucking band, but like the fact that Metallica covered it, and they were my Metallica and my sound, they covered Tuesday's Gone. I was so mad. This is the album I've never bought by Metallica.
Yeah, I don't know what possessed me to buy this album, but I guess it was just my lack of knowledge on what Metallica was. I was like, ooh, I like the Black Album. This says Metallica. This must be good.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't hate you for it.
Oh, well. I had to put it up there. It wouldn't be a Michael Sturgeon top 10 Metallica songs if that wasn't, like, top two.
Wasn't predominantly.
Yeah. I love that song. So, yeah, it's there.
Okay, so we'll move on to my number one, and I'm a little alarmed that no one has put this song out there yet. I don't know much about what John's going to have at number one. I know what Michael's going to have at number one, and nobody has said Creeping Death yet. So to me, it's like this is the definitive Metallica, the definitive thrash song, and I just, man, I don't even know where to begin.
Man.
I think it's perfect. The way it starts is so perfect. And I think they almost always open their shows with this now, from what I've seen from late videos. I've never seen them live myself, so I can't attest to it personally. But it's just such a perfect song. I'm going to leave it at that. It's always been my favorite.
I agree. I think it's a great song. But for me, it falls a little bit in that Inner Sandman realm where I've heard it so many times. And one of my buddies, we've talked about this before, but we've talked about what songs they've played live the most. And Creeping Death could be up there next to, like, the Seek and Destroy or something like that. Because they didn't always play Hit the Lights later on. And they kind of swoop back. But that or you know, some other songs, but they've probably played this live more than any other song that they've ever played. And I think it's just, for me, this song's a victim of just being overplayed. But, you know, it is an unbelievable song. I love the end. The solo's fantastic. It's a driving song, and it gets crowd involved. I mean, it is definitely a good song. I couldn't argue that this should not be in a number one slot, but I think for me, it's just I've heard it way too many times.
Gotcha.
I feel like, did you guys watch Power Rangers when you were kids?
Duh.
Yeah.
I feel like this is the song that the Power Rangers theme song ripped off of on the main riff. It just sounds so much like it, and I cannot help but hear the Power Rangers theme song whenever I listen to it. I love this song.
I need to listen to that one. Oh, that's a lot.
I remember it perfectly, and you're so right.
So they actually played this song all the, you know, Anthony, I was telling you, they play this song. This is one of the ones they play all the time on SiriusXM Liquid Metal, and it's obviously their favorite Metallica song. If you listen to Liquid Metal, you hear it all the time, and I've always liked this song a lot. They got a billion songs. How many can I put in the top 10, you know?
Yeah.
10, that's the answer. So that just didn't make it in there. So, yeah, I like this song because, you know, we talked a lot about some of our favorite songs, how they start off with that melodic, you know, lead-in. This is just, it just comes right in. I love it. It's great. It's it's right before the Call of Cthulhu, and it's right after a fantastic album, one of my favorite albums. Golly, mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a solid pick. I have no qualms there.
Thank you.
My number one, again, this list is, I don't know, really pinning down a number one song, to me anyway, is just almost impossible.
Stupid.
Yeah. but mine's Fade to Black. We've talked about it before. You know, it's an epic song. And again, I keep bringing this back, but this is, come on, 1984. I mean, they wrote this in, yeah. I think, 83. I mean, just... It's unbelievable that the time, that especially that the song's held up, and really even the early recordings of Metallica anyway, but this song, I know they did, they toured with Guns N' Roses and back in, I think it was like 91, I think, 92, and this is the song.
James almost killed himself.
Yeah, he burnt like his whole body on the song, and I don't know, I think I saw that on the Behind the Music of Metallica, and ever since then, I'm like, ooh. Like, I think about,
right.
You know, hey, he's got hurt on the song, and I don't know, for whatever reason, that makes me like it more. But, you know, it just hasn't, I just love Metallica being able to come up with, you know, clean riffs with solos over the top that just kind of follow the same format that is just unbelievable. And I think you might have mentioned Anthony before, but it's just the solo at the end just kind of, it flows with the song over the rhythm guitars. It's just unbelievable to me. And it's just such an epic song of theirs that it's number one in my book. It's been number one for a while, but yeah, so that's my logic, and I'm sticking to it, or whatever. Yeah. If that makes any sense.
Yeah, I mean, I talked about it quite a bit already. I mean, this is one of the reasons I picked up a guitar in the first place.
Sure.
And you know, I've been just trying to master those fucking solos forever, and I don't know, I love this song so much.
Yeah, it is. I mean, again, another song I didn't even touch on my top 10, but, you know, I don't know. It's one of their best songs, and I just didn't give it its due, because I figured you guys would talk about it anyway. That's kind of how I did my list. I wanted to hit on some of my favorite songs, and like, what are some songs that maybe they won't have, you know?
I like it.
So, it worked out. All right, well, my number one, Anthony already knows what it is, it's Dyer's Eve. I love Dyer's Eve. We talk about creeping death starting off with a punch in your face. That's what Dyer's Eve is. And John, you mentioned earlier, some people just, it's kind of, you love it or you hate it. I'm in the first category. So, this is my favorite Metallica song, bar none. I love how there is no slow part about it. The solo is my favorite solo of any Metallica song. It's just stupid fast. And did they play this one live?
They didn't for a long time because I think Lars couldn't pull off the double bass.
Surprising.
Yeah, they have. Yeah. They played it live. Yeah, exactly. they played it live recently, but I think Lars has been doing, I think ever since, I think Justice album was the last one they did, but he had like one of the larger drum sets. And after Justice, he pared it down to Black Album, and he took out a number of pieces of his drum set. And I think for whatever reason, again, I who the hell knows if this is true or not, but that he didn't play it because of some portion of his drum kit that is on that song that isn't on his regular kit, which sounds mm-hmm. stupid to me. But
it's possible.
From what everybody's hearing is that just the double bass part, he just couldn't do it live, so he didn't. They haven't been playing it, but yeah, but I do love the song. It's fantastic. It has a very Fire with Fire, Battery, Damage Incorporated type feel. It's just intense. Yeah. It blows you away the entire song. There's no let up. It's just in your face. But yeah, I like it a lot. But again, I think people either like it or they don't, just because of how just it starts out just in your face. So
yeah, I like it too. Good song.
Thanks, Anthony.
Well, you and I have had this conversation before.
Yeah, I know. I like that song. It's good.
It is a good song. Yeah. It's a good song.
Okay, thanks.
I just realized I don't think anybody put Master of Puppets in there.
Yeah, I had it in there, but I moved it out.
I had number six. It was on mine.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
But again, that yeah. has an Enter Sandman victim where it's overplayed, right. And that's what forces it up the list. I mean...
you could argue that that should be number one, and I would agree with you. But
absolutely, yeah. I mean, looking through the discography, there's so many. Like, I've literally got 10 honorable mentions. I just had to, like, well, I guess that'll be number 10. I went with Until It Sleeps, but it could have been I Disappear. I've always loved that song. It could have been Bad Seed, which is my my love affair from Reload. Could have been King Nothing, which actually maybe it should have been because I've always loved King Nothing. Could have been Hit the Lights. And I've always really liked Broken Beat and Scarred, too. That's my favorite song on Death Magnetic.
Yeah, I can't disagree with that. I always had a love for Hero of the Day. I've always loved that song. But I'd agree with you on all those.
Yeah, Hit the Lights is actually one of the... Before Master of Puppets, I actually had Hit the Lights up there at number 5 before I had to kind of shuffle it back. So I think that would have been my one left off.
Yeah.
And... yeah, we already talked about Master of Puppets. The Shortest Straw is actually another song I like a lot as well. That's another song that's just stupid fast. I remember, you know, you talking about Lars not being able to hang. I remember on the Guitar Hero Metallica, they actually had videos of Metallica trying to do the songs so that their characters would actually match up. And Lars had the hardest time trying to play his drums on The Shortest Straw. He would just, I remember he finally nailed it once, and he just fell off his thing like, fuck this, god damn, who the hell wrote this song, you know? But I like that song a lot. That's a cool song. So
cool, so that's going to round out our top 10. Good list, guys. Except for you, Michael, you can fuck off. That number 2 pick, I don't know about that.
Oh, though. Come on!
I do like the logic, though. I want to put other songs on here that you guys won't. I don't know if that's a cover-up or not, but I like it, though.
No, it's good. That was a good conversation. Okay, so moving on here, guys. Just want to kind of hit on some topics just to keep on talking about Metallica, kind of delve in a little bit deeper. And this is something I've always wondered, especially as big a fan of Megadeth as I am. For a while there, I might have considered myself a bigger Megadeth fan than Metallica. And the question is, would Metallica have been better off if they hadn't fired Dave Mustaine? And personally, well, I want to see what you guys think first.
Yeah, I can start it off. I absolutely agree 100% that they would not be better off. Just from the sheer fact of this band, just their personalities and dynamics. I mean, a lot of this came out during the Some Kind of Monster documentary where you can kind of see a little bit of a window into these guys. But,
right.
You know, with James and Lars, I mean, those are two alphas in the room. And I think Mustaine is also an alpha. And I think you throw three of those guys in a room, it's just... You have such a volatility of something that just is about to explode. I mean, there's no doubt that Mustaine is a better technical guitarist and songwriter than Kurt Hammond. I mean, it's just not. I don't think that's you can in my opinion argue it. I mean, Mustaine's great. I've always liked Megadeth. I've never liked Mustaine's voice. Megadeth and Ozzy Osbourne fit in the same category to me personally. I know a lot of people love it, and you mentioned you like the Black Sabbath a lot, but their voice always took away from the music to me. I wouldn't love to see a Metallica song with any background vocals with Mustaine. It just wouldn't sound right to me. I know that James is typically on recordings anyway, done his own background vocals, but, you know, it just, I don't think that the band would have lasted. I mean, they kicked Mustaine out after, I think, like a year or less than a year, just because he was a freaking nutcase. And, I mean, believe me, I'm a Megadeth fan. I actually went to, I think it was Vintage Vinyl. They did a CD signing for, I don't know what was the album after Cryptic Writings, but I actually got it. I think it was their song Crush 'Em, which was kind of a generic song.
Oh, Risk? Risk.
Yeah, so actually... we were able to get two things signed, and I got my Rust in Peace album signed by them, and then I got a Crush 'Em live single VHS tape signed by them.
So that's cool.
Wow. I have a VHS Megadeth single video signed by the band somewhere. I don't know where the hell it is. But. I'm sure that's worth a ton right now, but anyway.
Yeah, especially for their the like song that they hate that they wrote.
Yeah, exactly. But I just don't think that this band would have existed with the three alphas in the band. But,
yeah.
Yeah, that was kind of be my guess too, is that it just would have exploded the band, and if anything, you know, it would have maybe sent them all on separate paths, and then we maybe would have had, you know, completely different, maybe would have had, you know, nothing past maybe the first album, and that would have been it.
Right.
Just because I think it would have exploded everything, and maybe, you know, having three alphas like that, you could argue that maybe it would have caused dissension between most, and, you know, luckily, I guess, for James and Lars, Mustaine had some pretty big issues from what I know, and that kind of allowed them to team up and say, hey, you're out. So,
yeah, I mean, I don't think it ever could have worked either. Dave Mustaine, like, now he's got the reputation of probably being the toughest guy to work with in, like, the entire music history, maybe ever, you know,
sure.
From, like, any genre. But, you know, a part of me wonders if, no, I think a huge part of that is a direct result of being kicked out of Metallica with no warning. And, you know, ever since then, they kind of showed in that St. Anger documentary, you know, he's lived a life of being second best and just these constant reminders that he could have been a multimillionaire with tons of fans and media and that, you know, the record sales would be on his side as opposed to always, you know, being in second place. And you know, I've always felt a little sorry for the guy. Like, you know, he was crazy, but I don't know that he was, like, that much more dangerous than the other guys at the time. You know, they were super heavy drinkers as well. But getting back to it, yeah, I don't think that it would have lasted. I'm so glad they split up.
You know,
because, you know, Kirk is, like, a huge part of Metallica.
You know, it's funny, you mentioned that documentary with the Mustaine. I was reading an article. They said that apparently when that interview was done, it was with Lars and Mustaine, and they're all crying and everything in the room. That was apparently like a day or two after 9/11. So they said that everyone was just like, you know, emotions were high, and everyone's, you know, just very reflective and very emotional on everything. And apparently after they recorded that, they left, and it was, I don't know, a year later or something before. Some kind of monster documentary came out. Mustaine reached out to Lars and said, "Hey, can we cut that portion out? I don't want that to be shown." And Lars basically said, "No."
Yeah,
like I'm doing it.
Dave has never been more real, I think, or more open than he was on there. He just seems so vulnerable and so shaken up still by the fact that they kicked him out of Metallica and they went on to be, you know, one of the most successful artists of all time.
Well, and I mean, let's not you know, cry too many tears for Dave Mustaine. I mean, he's had a very wonderful career and sold millions of albums and, you know, is very well respected as a guitarist and songwriter. But
absolutely.
I loved that documentary. I think it was such a real, honest look. I've never seen a band do anything like that before. I mean, that willing to put something out and that Mustaine thing too. I mean, it's just like, you know, to let himself be seen like that, or well, at least he didn't want to afterwards, but just to even be able to do that on camera was pretty revealing. I enjoyed it.
Absolutely. And I think like only until recently he's had the sympathy of the metal community. And after, you know, now it's like, okay, it's been 30 years, man, it's time to get over it. But like, but in the meantime, you know, he had a whole lot of respect from, you know, everybody after getting kicked out of Metallica, because like, you know, Metallica makes the Load shift, even the Black Album to Load, to Reload, to St. Anger. But during that time, Dave Mustaine's off writing like, you know, Euthanasia and The World Needs a Hero, and what's the other one? United Abominations to Endgame. Like, those are all really great albums during the time when Metallica's, like, being experimental and taking off, like, 6 years in between each fucking album, you know? So, I don't know. Yeah, I think we all agree that would probably not have been the best. So, moving on here, I want to talk about Cliff Burton some more. It's so sad, like, even thinking about it now, that he died the way that he did. I mean, everybody knows, you know, the whole story with Kirk and Cliff. I don't know what they do, flip a coin or, like, cards. Draw cards or something.
Yeah, I think they're drawing cards.
Yeah, draw cards, and, you know, Kirk has to sleep in the front or the back or whichever one, and Cliff ends up dying, and it's the saddest thing in the world, because you never hear anything but great things about the guy, and you just wonder what would it have been like if he hadn't died. You know, how would the band have how would they have continued? Because you already talked earlier about how big of a force he was in writing, and I've read stuff that said that Cliff Burton really showed James Hetfield how to thrash, if you will, like how to play this kind of guitar. Yeah, and gosh, I mean, looking ahead, I don't know a lot about his demeanor because people don't really talk about it, but you wonder, would he have been able to handle being in the band with two egomaniacs like that as well as, you know, as well as Jason did, because eventually Jason had to leave. And it's just really interesting to think about where he would have gone. What would have been Justice for All sounded like if they didn't
wouldn't
turn been, down the bass, you know?
It wouldn't have been mixed like that, for sure.
Yeah.
Cliff Burton was still alive.
Absolutely. And it's really weird for me, because when I think about Metallica, the picture that comes up, it never has Cliff Burton. It's always got Jason Newsted. Like, that's who I think is the bass player of Metallica. Just because, like, that was the era that I joined in, and I like his gruff voice. I loved how dedicated he was to music, and I loved all his contributions. So, you know, would they have been better or worse? I really don't know that you can say, but I sure wish it hadn't happened.
I think they wouldn't have been different. I mean, do you think that Cliff would have been more interested in... Because I feel like the route that they went after Justice was more Newsted's style. His projects that have came out since then sound like that stuff. And Cliff
sure.
was a thrasher. So would they have even taken that left turn? I don't think so. But I don't know.
You know, it's interesting. They said, I think it was a documentary that they put out around S&M, and they said that Lars did an interview and said, he goes, what would, because you're doing stuff with the symphonies, like, what do your real fans think? He's like, what would Cliff Burton think? And Lars said, he goes, you know, Cliff was the one that was really into music theory, and he goes, and he actually loved classical music. And he said that Cliff, he goes, probably would be the most into this as anybody in the band, which I thought that was kind of interesting. Metallica put out, I think, Cliff 'Em All. I don't know if you guys have seen that or not, but it's basically a collection of live performances and, like, home videos of Cliff. From what I hear from him, just from interviews I've heard, is that he was a basically really laid-back guy, and he was really into music theory. And like you said, Anthony, with, you know, kind of teaching James Hetfield, I think that was that it was instrumental as far as James Hetfield's growth. But I think you wouldn't have seen a Justice for All album tune mixed like that, and it really would have. I think you would have seen more bass influence on Black Album had more bass influence than Justice did, but I think you'd get a lot more influence kind of on down the road on other recordings for sure.
Yeah, I mean, I just find myself wondering, like, would he have let Bob Rock, like, do what he did on the Black Album? So now after talking about Cliff Burton and kind of the old era of Metallica, I want to kind of, you know, compare the eras. I really think the Metallica's history can really be split into three different musical eras. And the first one's the classic one, you know, like from Kill 'Em All up to Justice. And then the second one started with the Black Album, where it's kind of on the edge between one and two. Like Black Album, and then Load and Reload, S&M, St. Anger, and then this new era where they basically don't do anything, but they did release Death Magnetic. So, you know, a really great question to me is, what caused the shift from Justice to Black Album? Because you're talking about, like, one of the, like, shining forces in progressive metal, like progressive metal history, which is Injustice for All, to something that's maybe closer to rock and roll than it is metal in the Black Album. And it's just a huge shift over the, you know, a period, I can't remember exactly how many years it is, like 3 or 4 years or something like that, that they went from Justice to the Black Album. And, you know, what caused it? That's what I want to know.
Well, great question.
I think Newsted had a lot to do with that. I remember on the Black Album that he had... What song was it that he had credit for writing? Or credit for
My Friend of Misery.
That's right. But I can't help but think, you know, I don't know how much you guys have listened to Newsted stuff, but I actually paid a lot of attention to it after he left. And the stuff sounds exactly like what they made in the 90s, and it still does today. I remember Liquid Metal like gave them basically a homecoming parade on the radio for coming out with a new album, a new band called Newstead, and it's the same stuff over and over again. He's a great bassist, but his songwriting, I think, definitely drove the band that way. Even though he might not have gotten credit for it, I think it definitely drove the band that way. And that would be my opinion, but hell, you guys know more than I do.
I think that definitely has something to do with it, but I think that the Injustice for All album, most of the recordings and everything and riffs and songwriting were already pretty much done, or at least were kind of in the hopper before Cliff died. So I think that there was a lot of influence still left from Cliff on that album. And yeah. I don't know if it was either, hey, let's hire a big-time producer, and if it was, you know, more Bob Rock influenced, or if it's just saying, hey, we put out one, we put out our first music video, we're getting kind of a taste of, kind of commercial success.
Money.
Exactly.
Yeah, money.
You know, and it's funny, too, there's several things, too, that James has broken his wrist like two or three times skateboarding, which they had to cancel shows. In 1986, they were supposed to actually be on Saturday Night Live in 1986 with Cliff Burton, and he broke his broke his wrist. So it's almost like, which that would have been really cool to see back. But
yeah, for sure.
But yeah, I think that the band, you know, just had some kind of their toe in the water as far as, you know, larger commercial success, and maybe they said, okay, well, we can either, you know, make a lot of money here, or, you know, the band just got so much publicity, think we're going to hire a big-time producer and just do a heavily produced album and subsequent large tour, and maybe that had something to do with it. I'm not positive on what exactly it was, but I think dollar signs showed up a little bit, and I think that they're just long, toe in the water of commercial success just kind of springboarded them into the next phase for sure.
Yeah, I think it's a lot of Bob Rock, because you always hear these horror stories about the recording process for the Black Album, and it went like over a year or something like that, and like three marriages ended, and they had to be there all the time. And, I remember reading something that Kirk Hammett would write like literally hundreds of riffs. And it's like, okay, so did Bob Rock sit there and like listen to stuff forever until it's like, yeah, that's a moneymaker right there, you know?
Sure.
And you hear talking about, Lars mentioned it later on, I think maybe in the Some Kind of Monster one, or maybe it was the Black Album sessions when they went back and talked about it. I don't know if you guys have seen that one.
Yeah.
And he said, we don't have a lot of like room to play around with you guys playing so fast. So they, play some songs that are a lot slower. That's how you get like Sad But True, a song that I fucking hate, by the way. Sorry. the Wherever I May Roam and stuff like that. And I think it has a lot to do with Bob Rock. And maybe they're just not as pissed off as they used to be, because they've had so much success. And at that point, they're basically ruling the metal world. They had just like spawned so many different genres of metal at that point. And it's like, can you really, like, can you thrash like that if you're not mad anymore and, you're successful? It's a drastic musical shift, and I've always been fascinated by what motivated them to do that.
Well, from what I've read, from Black Album to Load, it was Lars and I think Kirk and even James had a kind of obsession more with blues and kind of more jazzier type feel, and that's what kind of led to that. But, yeah, I guess I've never really put the pieces together as far as Justice to Black Album, because like you said, it was such a small period of time to have that dramatic of a change. It's interesting.
Yeah, for sure. And like from Black to Load is just as big of a difference to me. I think it was the Behind the Music documentary that said that like Kirk went to art school and Jason, they finally let Jason like really get in there and like doodle around a lot with Kirk, and they let those guys write a lot. Cause I think James and Lars are like the primary songwriters, and they have been for a long time, like back to the Cliff days. But Load, I mean, I can't imagine what it would have been like if Load came out instead of the Black Album. Like, that would have just been just crushing to metal fans.
Yeah, at least they've led you down a path of getting
to
Load.
A buffer.
Exactly. Yeah, if you go Justice to Load, that people would revolt even more than they did with, you know, Napster or something.
So Michael, you might have said this earlier. Are you a fan of Load?
Yeah, it's all right. I mean, there's songs on there I like. I feel like I liked Reload more.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm wow. The opposite of that.
Yeah.
Reload's probably one of my least favorite albums.
Yeah, it's one of my least favorite albums, but if I'm going to say between the two, I feel like just what I like, Reload more, but they're both in my, you know, at the bottom of the list of as far as albums that I enjoy.
Yeah, you know, the thing with Reload to me is, like, even James said, I think, once that a lot of those songs are, like, super mediocre, and they just, like, polished them over and over again until they were good enough to, like, put out. And then either, I think that might have been in the Some Kind of Monster documentary, too.
Yep.
It's like, you know, we could just put anything out, and it'll be fine. You know, we did that with Load and Reload. So the question for me is, are there songs that, you know, that they can be proud of on those albums? And I think, you know, there's a resounding yes from at least John and I. Earlier we swooned over Bleeding Me. I've always been a big fan of King Nothing. You mentioned Hero of the Day. I even like Ain't My Bitch quite a bit.
Sure.
I don't know.
No, that's a good thing. You know, I look at Reload as like they picked out the best songs, because it's supposed to be a double album.
Right.
They picked out the best songs for Load, and then the rest of it they said, okay, let's just throw it on Reload.
Right.
We'll have our fuel, we'll have our, you know, kind of lead song that we can get radio airplay from, but the rest, that's just kind of how I always looked at it. I mean, I don't know if that was the thought process or not, but that's what I always felt like. That was the backroom decision anyway.
I think they still play The Memory Remains live, don't they?
You know, Memory Remains, I never really liked it. I didn't like the video. I didn't like anything. That is one of their better live songs. Because
that's so cool, isn't it?
Yeah, they have that Marianne Faithfull da-da-da part, and they get the crowd to do it. And it is, like, super cool to hear live and to be there in person. Because they'll sit there, and Kirk will kind of play just a kind of a non-distorted guitar, and there's, like, no drums, and then the whole crowd's, like, singing that part. And it just gives you chills. It's one of the cooler live songs that they play.
Yeah, yeah. So then this next, like, minor question to go along with this might be geared more towards Michael, because if you don't listen to a lot of modern metal, John, but do you think, Michael, that metal fans are justified in hating everything post-Justice album? Like, do you think they're sellouts?
Yeah.
Yeah, they are.
I think, well, John, to give you a little background, there we did an episode where we had reviewed Metal Sucks. It's a popular metal, you know, news site, and basically they let metal musicians.
Is it like Blabbermouth or something like that?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
They let metal musicians rank their top five. It was like a point-based system based on where they ranked certain bands. They put Metallica at number 10. Wasn't it number 10, Anthony?
No, they were like number 4.
What? Were they? Okay, probably.
Yeah, because remember Slayer was just above.
That's right. And Anthony had a real big problem with that. And I remember having a conversation with Anthony. I was like, Anthony, the metal community has spoken here. I mean, and then, I don't know. The fans put them a lot higher. No, I can't remember. We can edit this shit. Fuck.
No, this is good. This is gold, bro.
But, I don't know. My whole stance was, okay, if Metallica is going to go and do what they did and not expect backlash from fans that absolutely crave what they did when they started, then this is what they can expect. Not you know, outlash or backlash from the metal community, but just more of a, okay, well, we're going to put you to the side until you fix your shit, and we're going to listen to Dave Mustaine and Megadeth and Testament and these new bands that are starting to come out in the late 90s. And I think that's kind of what maybe has put hindrance on maybe the love for Death Magnetic, because it is a solid album. But I don't know. I really feel like it totally was justified. Whether you like Reload or Load or not, the metal community does not.
You know, it's so funny, though. Like, you know, other bands, what they would always do is, you know, these guys would do side projects. You know, they would, you know, someone would go off and do something. Like, I'm a big Foo Fighters fan, and they're one of their guitarists, really, you know, one of, is a country music fan, and he does a side project. It's basically a country album. And I think that the Foo Fighters are like, okay, well, we're going to do what the Foo Fighters do, and if you want to do something else, then go ahead and just do it, but it's just not going to be under the Foo Fighters' name. You know, that's something that Metallica just hasn't let their band members do, which, you know, pretty much led to Jason leaving. But I think that Metallica said, okay, we're going to do whatever we want to do, and if you want to do something different, then too bad. But, you know, if we're going to do our own side projects within the band, you know, so if we're going to feel like we're going to do something like Load and Reload, then we're just going to do it. And I think that not allowing the side project happen, then you see some variability on their albums and not giving, you know, the exact cookie cutter stuff that you're going to get. You're going to get something kind of real and raw that's not, that's going to be under the Metallica name.
Yeah, absolutely. And
regardless if you like it or not. And I don't think they really care. You know, I don't think Lars really cares that if people didn't like Load or Reload. But
oh, I agree.
Wrong, but.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But still. it's almost like after those came out and they realized what they were getting from the metal community, and, you know, then they're mad about Napster and they're mad about Jason leaving, and then they come out with this almost fake mad album, like they're trying to get mad again so they can make a decent metal album, and that's what Saint Anger is to me. It's just, I don't know, it's just, it seems like it became completely fake after that, and yeah. They have gotten back. Obviously, you know, the movie helped that, and I feel like, you know, coming out with a good album, they've kind of gotten back to a little more you know, transparency. But I think that was those were some dark days for the metal community as far as the viewpoint on Metallica.
Yeah, so that leads to my next question, and it's, just how bad is Saint Anger? Because after Reload, they took a pretty interesting risk with the S&M thing, which I think a lot of people were maybe, I don't want to say they were embarrassed to say it, but a lot of people just kind of avoid talking about S&M to, like, avoid letting on that they actually are Metallica fans of that era. Personally, sure. I think S&M's my third favorite Metallica album. Like, if I consider that, you know, take that in consideration with all the other albums, that's number three on my favorite albums list. I absolutely love S&M. And so when they were put out this new one and it's everywhere and the fist is, you know, on the cover and it looks mean and it's called Saint Anger, which is really dumb, but it's Metallica, so I'm going to buy it. And I'm just so pumped up and holy shit, that's not what I wanted, you know?
You know, I think there's good songs on the album. I really like Frantic. The first time I heard it, especially,
yeah.
The lyrics were cool, had kind of a Metallica feel to it, but literally, I heard it, they did MTV Icon, and
right,
I think the first time Frantic premiered, they played it live at the end of the show, and I'm like, wow, this is a really, really cool song, I'm super excited for this album. I remember getting the album, putting it in, and Frantic started, and I'm thinking, what's this pinging sound coming from? Is that the snare drum? I mean, what is that? And it's all over the album. And I became obsessed with it, and it totally took away from my enjoyment of the album. I just thinking, what in somebody's right mind would you do this? And
it ruined it.
Well, I think that, and then how they recorded it, which they just got in a room and just started playing songs. They're just playing, and then they had, you know, 3-4-5 hour jam sessions, and they'd edit them down, and then that would be the song. Which,
right.
You know, so they had like a garage feel. It's like, okay, well, that all sounds good and everything, but at the end of the day, the song has to be good. And I think that they just took some of these jam sessions and threw them in and made them a song, and they were not songs. I remember Lars in an interview when Saint Anger came out, and he said that this this album could be commercial suicide. And I'm thinking, and when I read that, I'm just like, that's not good. Like, that does not get me excited. You know, believe me, I don't want to, I want to see them do their thing and, you know, being like a Black Album or something like that. But, you know, Black Album was a good album. I mean, very commercial, yes, but you're saying something's commercial suicide. I don't want them, you know, farting on a snare drum or something like that, you know, just to try to get and hit record just to hear Metallica. I mean, I want to hear catchy, good songs. And that just, I like Sweet Amber was a good song on that. Some Kind of Monster was actually a really good song when I heard an edited version, a radio version for Some Kind of Monster, that they edit out a ton of the kind of garbage in it. And it actually, the edited version is way better than the regular song, in my opinion. And Frantic was
Yeah, Some Kind of Monster is 8 minutes long. It needs to be 4 minutes long. That would be good, because it's a really good riff.
Mm-hmm.
It's a heavy-ass riff, and it's really good.
But I can't stand that snare drum. That snare drum is it makes me hate the entire album.
You know what's worse than the snare drum to me? I think there's two things really, like, fundamentally wrong with the album. One of them is the snare drum, and the other one is the fact that, like, James Hetfield didn't, like, do what he normally does in recording. I don't know if it's just, like, he didn't try, or they just wanted him to not, like, do it over 100 times to make it sound good, or what, but he sounds like fucking garbage on this album. And it's so distracting, it's so awful, but there are songs I like. Sweet Amber's good. I really like Frantic. The song Saint Anger has a lot of really cool riffs, and actually James Hetfield has a really vicious scream in that song that I like quite a bit. It's near the end.
Mm-hmm.
My favorite song on the album is Dirty Window. I don't know if you guys know that song well enough to remember. It's just got a really cool, like, groovy kind of, like, just like this, just punching riff that they build the song around. It's cool. I know Michael hates this album, but are there any songs that you like on it?
Yeah, Frantic, Some Kind of Monster, and Sweet Amber. So
yeah,
that's it. I don't like anything else on this album. I went and listened to it again. I remember creating a burn CD from high school, and I pulled it out, and we were driving somewhere. I had my buddy Gary in the car with me, and I played Saint Anger, and I think it's just because that was the single when it came out. And Gary said, "What the fuck is this? This is awful." And I said, "This is Metallica." He said, "No, it's not." I'm like, "Yes, it is. This is Metallica." I was like, "Dude, you need to look this up." And he's like, "Oh my god, this is Metallica. This is awful." I remember, like, 105.7 The Point in St. Louis, like, saying, "We just threw a Saint Anger album out the window while driving down the highway. Call us if you do the same thing," you know? Just god. Like, there was no love for this album. Like, whether you're a commercial fan of Metallica or whether you're a fan of the old stuff, I did not understand the driving force that made this album come. And I think it's not too far from the truth to say that they probably regret this album, especially since they don't play anything. Even some of the good songs they don't play.
You know what though? I don't think. Let me say this. I don't think that they regret it. I think that they absolutely needed this album to stay together, but
sure.
I don't think that they should have put it out. I think they should have kept this one to themselves.
I agree. It's by far their worst album, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's just no way about it. I mean, you guys, there's just a lack of catchy songs. And I just remember when that Saint Anger single came out. I'm like, so they're really repeating the same verse over and over and over throughout the song? Like, there's no, like, they didn't have anything else to say, you know? Like, that's annoying. All right, so next song.
Yep. All right, so that moves on. I think it was 2008 when they finally put out Death Magnetic. And the big question here is, we've all said we enjoy it. Do you consider it like a return to form, or do you think it's like a desperate attempt at appeasing fans of their old material?
Both.
Do you think this is an album that they wanted to make?
Yes. Well.
Well, and I wonder if it's some of the backlash from Saint Anger had anything to do with it. You know, I wonder if that.
I think they took their time making this one, for sure.
Well, Rick Rubin produced it, so, you know, who's done everything. I mean, from metal to country or whatever. But I think that I love this album. I don't know if the backstory is if they tried to appease fans by this or not, but from just the fact of what songs they play live now, just being such all the old heavy stuff, and they've been doing that for years now. I don't necessarily believe that they were forced to do this to just try to appease fans, but on the other side, I love this album. I love it from front to back. They even came out with like four songs that missed the cut. The Beyond Magnetic, they had four songs that actually weren't too bad either. But it's in your face. And again, I said it earlier, but it has a lot of similarities on paper to Master of Puppets, just with the instrumentals and the dynamics of some of their songs. Data Never Comes is, you know, it's kind of a, I think that gets kind of glossed over, but if that song was on Injustice for All, people would say that that's one of the better songs of all time. But
probably.
It's just, I think it's a, like you guys said, it's a kind of victim of the time where, you know, some of the Pantera guys are saying it's the worst piece of shit in the world, and basically everything after the Black Album never existed. I think that this album doesn't get the time of day because people said, oh, that's new Metallica, they suck, and that's it.
Right.
So. Yeah, and that's kind of how I felt about it when it first came out before I actually gave it a listen. But, you know, I think if you're a metal fan, I mean, I don't see how you can't enjoy at least most of the album. I talked about All Nightmare Long, how much I love that song. I really liked The End of the Line. That was just your life. Oh, man, this is...
That's a great song.
Yeah. I mean, what a good
four
start.
Or five songs are just unbelievable.
Yeah. I mean, what a kick-ass start to the album. I didn't really care for, I would say after Cyanide, I kind of lose it a little bit with The Unforgiven 3, Judas Kiss. Suicide and Redemption's, I like that song. My Apocalypse is good too. So I don't understand, you know, I can understand the taking it back of, oh, new Metallica, it must suck. Yeah, exactly. After what they've done, it's hard not to, but I really feel like this was them coming back to form, saying, okay, this is what we are now after all of the transitioning and wanting to find themselves and, you know, everything. I think this, if we can expect more of Death Magnetic, I think they will, you know, I think they'll be all right.
Well, I think Lars did an interview recently, and he's talking about their writing songs now, and I think they said they're almost on the point where to head into the studio to record their next album. And Lars said, because they said, how are these songs? How are they, you know, are they heavy? You know, what's, can you describe them at all? And he said that, because these new songs have a very thick Death Magnetic feel to them, which that got me super excited. Because, if new music that you're going to come out with is something like this, I think that that's an awesome direction that I'm excited to listen to.
Yeah, I think it's the best classic Metallica that we could hope for at this stage of their careers.
Absolutely.
Let's be honest, like, they're not those guys anymore. They're one of the most successful bands of all time. I already said that. I mean, if you count Linkin Park, or if you don't count Linkin Park, then they're the only metal band ever with a diamond album, and they've got three of those. So, the fire's probably not there, the ones that drove those first few albums. But this one, I think it is pretty good. I'm going to compare it to... this comparison would just infuriate some people, but earlier... In one of our earlier episodes, we covered a band that I've been a massive fan of for most of my life, Nonpoint, and they've got like seven albums or so. And what I said with that new album is that, you know, there's only one song in this album that I really feel like is going to stand the test of like the fans. Like I only consider one of these album or one of these songs existent. With this album, I consider about five of these songs existent. Does this make sense? Are you guys following me?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, yeah, like five of these songs I want to hear live from now until forever. And that's what I consider a successful album, because I don't want to hear that shit with Saint Anger. I don't want to hear any of those songs live, you know. But this one, I want to hear That Was Just Your Life. I want to hear Broken, Beat, and Scarred. I want to hear The Day That Never Comes. And I like Unforgiven 3. I don't know if I want to hear it live necessarily, but I do like that song. I just feel like... This is probably the best that they can do if that's the type of album they want to make.
This would have been perfect if, you know, if after Justice for All, they wanted to get a little bit more modern, maybe just a hair radio, more radio friendly, if this would have been the transition, something like this, then I don't think the anguish towards or the anything like that from the metal community ever would have come, because this makes sense. You're getting older, you're not as angry anymore. Lars can't play shit for drums, so as far as double bass goes. So this is a good route to go.
Well, and also too, you look at this point in these guys' lives, I mean, you know, how much money can Lars and James have in the bank right now?
Oh my God.
I mean,
a lot.
Unbelievable. I mean, when they sold tons of albums when people still bought albums, and these guys tour, they've toured their ass off. I mean, which is, it always gets frustrating when they announce a Middle Eastern tour that they're going to take a year break before and after on, because they're not anywhere near the rest of us. But, you know, these guys have to be one of the richest musicians going. I mean,
Absolutely. You
look at even like pop music today, just like Taylor Swift and everything. You know, I'm sure she has a bunch of money, but there's no. I mean, people don't really buy albums. They really make their money touring, and these guys have been doing it forever. And I just think, what's the motivation? I mean, what's they have them say? I want to go and Kirk just go surf all day and not pick up a guitar, you know, or James do something else. It's just, what is a reason to even pick up the guitar and play new music? And the fact that they are still doing it is just, I'm very thankful that they are, just because of how wildly successful they are. They have really no reason. They have nothing else to prove. So I've loved Death Magnetic, and I'm excited for their new stuff, just from what I'm hearing of just being so much like Death Magnetic. So, you know, just the idea of them even making new music is just, you know, if I was in their shoes, I could easily see that, you know, me going, well, I have several hundred million in the bank. I have, you know, kids growing up. You know, let's just, I don't feel like living in a hotel room for 2 years, you know. So let's calm it down a little bit. But
yeah, I mean, you know, the Black Album sells like about a million albums every year, like literal physical albums.
Which is unbelievable, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that came out in like 91 or something, you know? So, like 17 million total worldwide. It's just insane. So, like, Taylor Swift's probably got money, but she does not have Metallica money.
Absolutely not.
No.
So, I mean, yeah, so getting back to Death Magnetic, I feel like, you know, maybe it's not the most honest album where they are musically in their own lives, but I think it was one for the fans. And many of us, like, even those, like, you know, us three who like Load and Reload to an extent, we've been waiting for a classic style follow up to Justice for most of our lives. So, thank you. You know? So moving on, we can start to sort of wrap this up a little bit. I do have another couple little questions. You know, everybody rags on Lars all the time, and it's totally justified. It is, because the Napster thing, and he's shown on many occasions, like, this guy is not a super cool dude, probably. Or maybe he is, and he just comes off wrong. You know, I don't know. But my question, I've always kind of felt like James Hetfield is glossed over quite a bit. I think that dude is a huge baby and really hard to work with. And it's just like every shred of my mind tells me that he, not Lars, creates many, many, many of the problems in the band. And especially in the St. Anger documentary, I felt justified in thinking this, because you could see what his alcoholism did in those early 2000s. His petty bitch fits and, like, refusing to let Jason Newsted do something in the 5 years they want to take off between every album led to him leaving the band when he was someone who's musically 100% dedicated to Metallica. That's all he wanted to do, was make music, and if Metallica was active, he would have been your guy forever and ever, because he didn't get married, he didn't, you know, he's got no kids, no nothing, and he swore it off because he dedicated himself to music. And I just feel like, wow, you know, Robert Trujillo has been really, really good because he's a master bass player, but Jason is the guy. Like, he would have been the guy forever.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, that documentary did show a lot, and I've heard before that James has had, you know, kind of a come to Jesus, you know, thought with some of these, and he said that basically, I think he said his mom passed away when he was a kid. His dad left the family when he was like a young teenager. And mm-hmm. it was just him and I think his sister or brother or something like that. And they were kind of on their own. And from what I read and what I've heard from James, he said that basically is that I never really learned how to love anything before. So he goes, what I did was, he goes, if I love something, then that means I'd strangle it to death. And wouldn't, you know, it's like, I think James said before, he's like, why would you leave? You know, you can't leave. I'm not letting you leave because this is mm-hmm. what you do. And, yeah, I think that Lars gets, you know, and Lars is kind of a, you know, he is an egomaniac. I mean, there's no way around it. You know, he's just a,
yeah.
But I think James, you know, James was the reason why Jason left. I mean, there's, and Jason said it several times, really, but it's not allowing, you know, like you said, not allowing to do anything. But James is just such kind of an asshole, I think, that doesn't yeah. really get picked up, for sure. But I think that's, you know, him with Lars, just with their kind of ego and drive of want to keep this thing going, I think that's what's kept it going. So it's interesting to think about if James was more laid back and more, you know, kind of I guess not a dick to all of his band members, and you know, let Kurt write a song or do anything like that, you know. But you know, it's funny to think about if he wasn't like that, would the band even have continued? You know, but yeah, I agree with you.
I just feel like Lars takes a lot of shit from a lot of people, you know? And I start to feel for the guy, because nobody ever talks good things about Lars. You hear all the time, James is the best rhythm metal guitarist of all time, which I happen to agree with. Mm-hmm. That guy's chops are just unbelievable. Though he can downpick things that I can't, like, alternate pick, you know? Like mm-hmm. it's pretty insane. Well, Lars, meanwhile, I think... Oh, you can go ahead.
No, you know, with Lars, you know, kind of getting a bad rap, I heard on, I didn't really know this until they did like an hour and a half long Howard Stern interview, and they were saying that Lars is really the glue in the band that on all the songs, because he said that Kirk and James, they'd write riffs and they'd give them tapes, basically. They'd put it on tape and then hand it to Lars. And Lars would then sit down with it and kind of say, okay, this part needs to go here, this riff goes here, and is, from what I've heard anyway, is like, pretty much the arranger of all Metallica songs, and
yeah,
he's been doing that for forever. So I think what he lacks in skill level, which I mean, there's you can pick out of a hat a better technical drummer in the metal community over Lars, but it's just interesting to think, you know, saying, oh yeah, it'd be easy if they had a better or different drummer, that Metallica would have been better just because of skill, but I think that. His arrangement, I think, doesn't get his due credit. Because he's the absolutely. One who pretty much wrote, for the most part, most Metallica songs with James. Mm-hmm. But yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think Scott Ian said it in his book that came out. Oh, was it a book? It might not have been a book. Maybe it was an interview last year. He said, like, you know, when they started out, like, Lars couldn't even really, like, play the drums at all. Mm-hmm. You know, it's pretty impressive. So he never tried to play outside of his realm of ability. But he did use his talents, and I think you're right with the arranging thing. You know, if you watch the videos of Metallica in the studio, you never see Lars, like, discussing arrangement with the other band members. It's always him and, like, the producer.
Mm-hmm.
He's like, no, we're going to move this to here and this
yep.
to here, and then we're going to do a breakdown. And then he's listening to a part, and he's like, wait, stop. What if we did a chin-chin?
Yeah.
right there, just build it up. And it's crazy. That's always how the songs turn out. And even, like, the Enter Sandman riff, when Kirk brought it to him, that's not the riff. Like, the riff we have today is not what Kirk brought him.
Yeah.
You know, Lars put that together. He just gets a bad rap. I feel for the guy.
It would have been interesting, too, in a different different life if he never would have hooked up with James and, you know, been a drummer. I could have seen him be a, you know, like a producer, music producer,
uh-huh.
and probably been pretty successful with it. But
yeah, absolutely. Michael, you want to jump in? I know we cut you out.
You guys are good. You guys are good. I don't think that, you know, I think, John, you hit it on the head. There's plenty of drummers out there that could have done a better job of drumming for Metallica, you know, but I don't think Metallica would exist without him or have continued. I could see him probably maybe, I don't know, they're probably going to keep making music, but if they ever decide to just finally retire instead of, you know, quitting sounds like ripping off the Band-Aid, but if they ever decide to retire Metallica, I could totally see him, producing for someone or something like that, putting something together like that.
Right. I can't imagine Metallica with a different drummer. He always does exactly what the song needs, you know?
Sure.
And so what does he sit back there? He's super charismatic and he just beats the living hell out of those drums, you know? he looks super mean while he does it and just kicks the shit out of those drums and plays so hard. And I think if you ask anybody in metal history, you know, would you want Metallica with a different drummer? Nobody would say yes. Nobody would like really, really say yes because he's the guy.
No, you can't say that because then, it's not like you didn't, do those earlier albums. Not like they had a different drummer who died in a bus accident. Lars has been there the entire time.
Yeah.
So.
It's like Step Brothers. They beat the shit out of those drums, Dale.
And the other thing is, I don't think like he was universally regarded as a douchebag until the whole Napster debacle.
Sure.
And for that, like to me, it's just because he's the one who had the balls to stand up and be like, "You guys are stealing my money, and I want my money. Like,
well,
that's my money."
He definitely got up the shit end of the stick on that one. But it's interesting too that when the whole Napster situation, there was so many bands that were behind him that there was basically like an organization that Lars was in front, basically the point person for. It was like Garth Brooks and Sheryl Crow, and I think it was like Korn was on there. There was a bunch of rock bands too. But Lars happened to be the person that was, the point person on it, and so he got all the shit, and everyone else didn't even touch anyone else's radar.
Yeah, let's be honest. Napster was like a really bad thing for music. Like it was going to lead us down a path that was not going to be good. And also, all of our computers would be flooded with viruses. Like if we were still playing with Napster,
Sure.
Like it was just, I never really took issue with it, and I can't imagine life without Spotify now. So, who knows? He may have led to Spotify. All right. So to wrap this thing up, it's been a blast talking Metallica. Finally, for the past 2 hours or whatever.
I agree. It's been fun for sure.
To wrap this up, I want to see if we can hammer out what we consider to be the best Metallica album, not just our favorite. I'll tell you right now, Ride the Lightning is my favorite Metallica album. I don't consider it the best.
Sure.
So I'm interested to see what you guys think is the best.
Well, I think I said this before we started, that I think most of these Metallica albums, you could get a good argument to say why it's the best. Justice for All, it's intense. It's terribly mixed, but there's so many good songs on that. In my opinion, with Michael saying with Dyer's Eve, and I love To Live Is To Die, and even just outside of the one, but Black Album, I could see you put an argument with that, but really it's from top to bottom. There's not really a bad song on it. My favorite is probably Master Puppets, just because it just seems like it's, every song is great. It was made in 1986. It's just unbelievable that year you could put something out like that, that we could talk now, whatever, how many years that was, years ago, that it's still relevant. It's just unbelievable. I love Ride the Lightning. I love Kill. I love all their albums, but I think Master of Puppets is just such a, from top to bottom, such a revolutionary sound. Trivium did a Master of Puppets cover.
It was awesome.
Yeah, exactly. There's just so many, even modern rock bands that have done covers of it. And it's up there on everyone's most influential album list. You could totally see why, but I think that's probably the best in my opinion. But I could go any direction as far as being argued anyway, because I think that there's so much, they have so much going for them.
Master gets your vote then?
Yeah, that'd be my vote, I guess.
Okay.
It's so tough.
I think
it's so tough, because I look at Justice, and to me, that's my favorite album. I'm like you, Anthony, but I'm sitting here on Spotify looking at between, Master of Puppets and Ride the Lightning, and I feel like it should be one of those two, just because Justice, it falls short in the actual production. But I don't know. I look at those two albums and I like them both, but I keep going back to Justice. Do we take out everything from Load Onward, right? And we don't include Kill 'Em All, correct?
Yeah, I don't think you can look at Kill 'Em All and say that's the best album. I mean, you know, definitely if you're really into, you know, kind of early 80s thrash kind of thing, I could see how that would appeal to people over other albums, but I don't know. I think there's a number of songs there that, I mean, these guys wrote these songs at like 17 years old. I mean,
just weren't there yet.
Exactly. I think that they just haven't progressed yet. And I even look at an album like Ride the Lightning, and the song Escape is just, I think is, I'm not a big fan of it. It has kind of a funky feel to it. It almost has kind of a pop rock Motley Crue type feel to it. And I think that that song, if they deleted that song off the album, I would have put Ride the Lightning over Master Puppets.
I could see that. But I just look at the rest of the album, Fight Fire with Fire, Ride the Lightning, From Whom the Bells Toll, Fade to Black, Trapped Under Ice, Creeping Death, Call of Cthulhu. It's like, holy shit.
That's great. Yeah.
That is an awesome album right there.
Maybe I should switch to Ride the Lightning. I don't know.
I don't know, Master of Puppets, I mean, Battery, Master of Puppets, oh my gosh, Disposable Heroes, Orion, oh my gosh. I don't know. It's got to be one of the four. I keep switching back, but then all of a sudden I'll scroll up. Oh, there's Injustice for All. So I like that one too. Anthony, what do you think? Maybe I'll come to a decision. We'll come back to me.
Well, like I said, like Ride the Lightning is my favorite, and it's always going to be my favorite. I even like Escape. Like it's you know, my least favorite song on the album, but I do like it. But to me, I got to look at this from a more broad perspective, and we've talked about Master of Puppets at length already, and that is still like the formula, that's the groundwork for modern metal still. So many like super, super successful bands just straight rip that shit off. Like Trivium, like Lamb of God pulls a lot from Master of Puppets. Michael's going to hate that I said that, but they do. Metalcore, that's like straight out of Battery. In general, and I just feel like Master of Puppets is the formula for modern metal, and it probably is always going to be. And then you look at the Black Album, which is the other one I think is the main one in the conversation. If you guys had both said Ride the Lightning, I would have been like, oh yeah, okay, I'm with you, Ride the Lightning. But to me, the reason that I have to say that the Black Album, their self-titled, is the greatest Metallica album, is that this is and always will be the gateway for people into basically any kind of metal. And it was then when I was a kid, and it is now still. Like if you're trying to get somebody into metal, chances are they already know Enter Sandman because it's played at every live sporting event ever. And it's just there's heavy songs on it, there's light songs on it. You get a taste for like a pretty broad spectrum of metal, and you can just, you know, work your way on from there. You know, your friend introduces you to it, it's like, oh, you like the heavier stuff, well, here's Megadeth, here's Slayer, you know, and you just broaden your way. And I think the appeal of the Black Album is why I still have to say that that's the best one.
I changed my mind, Master of Puppets. I'm going to agree with John, just so it's not the Black Album.
Oh, gosh. Gotcha. Well, yeah, I'm fine with either one of them.
Well, again, I can be argued into any of them. And I actually, you know, it sounds almost blasphemous too, but I think you could put in a solid argument for Death Magnetic being up there. Not necessarily the best album, you know, obviously not most influential because of just the time it came out, but I love that album, and I don't know, you could put a point up to it where at least it'd have an argument, but I don't know. I love Red Lightning, Master of Puppets, and Justice for All. Those three are like in my, we played at my funeral, that kind of thing, yeah. So, by the way, if I die tomorrow, just put a note, To Live Is To Die, you can just put that in play. It'll be guaranteed to get everyone's crying. So, you know, there you go.
Cool. Well, yeah, I'm willing to concede. Probably Master of Puppets. And I think that's probably the general consensus. It's just so hard to choose. Absolutely. It really comes down to just whichever one hits you the hardest, you know, the soonest. Sure. And for me, it was Ride the Lightning. I didn't listen to Master of Puppets until after Ride the Lightning, so that's probably why. But hey, John, I want to thank you for joining us. It's been a blast finally talking about Metallica. We've been meaning to do this forever, right, Michael?
Yeah, we've been talking about it forever. I'm glad we were able to all get together and talk.
Yeah, it was great. Thanks for having me, guys. It was a lot of fun. Yeah.
No problem. Maybe we'll see you again sometime, all right?
Sounds good.
Later, guys.
All right, that's gonna wrap things up for this week. The next time we do this, I have no fucking idea when it's gonna be, because pretty soon I'm gonna be going out onto the ocean for extended periods of time, and that sucks. But we'll get around to it sometime, and I really want to talk black metal next time. So maybe Michael will let us do that, huh?
Maybe I will.
Maybe. All right. We'll see y'all next time.
Bye-bye.